Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. For fans of the Kansas City Royals, the thrills of last season just seem to spill over into this year. As the playoffs loomed, the boys in blue went into last night's contest with a 10-game lead in the division. Later on this hour, we'll look at just how well situated they are to make it back to the World Series. Also today, breaking news this morning about a major new development in the 18th and Vine neighborhood, and it involves what else? Baseball. We start today with a field that in recent decades has had a strong influence on baseball and now drives much of what happens in our everyday lives. That's economics. Economists, the people who develop theories and policies that affect production, pricing, and consumption of goods and services, became the target of a lot of blame in 2007 when the housing bubble burst and the Great Recession started. The thinking then, the public should have been warned. Not so fast, says Robert Lighton. With both a law degree and a PhD in economics from Yale, Lighton has spent four decades with the economics as an educator and a consultant with the Brookings Institution and with a place we know well in this town, the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation. His latest book is Trillion Dollar Economists, How Economists and Their Ideas Have Transformed Business. And Bob, nice to have you. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Up to Date producer Danny Alexander read this book and wants to know why they didn't teach economics like this when she was taking business classes.
Well, actually, I wrote it in part for my daughter, thinking that after she took economics, she should have had a book like this. I also wrote it for business people, because to be perfectly frank, a lot of business people think economists are ivory tower.
Yes, a lot of us do.
Stuffed shirts who produce all these crazy theories that have no application in the real world. And I wanted to write a down-to-earth book showing them that that view is wrong, that in fact economists have had ideas that have been implemented directly in business and made people lots of money.
Well, let's get into this right away then. I mean, the Great Recession, why did so many of your fellow economists not see it coming or were slow to warn us that it might happen, Bob?
Well, first, I should clarify.
Because people are still mad about that.
Of course they are. And in fact, the presidential campaign is revealing that to a great extent. By the way, they're not only mad at economists, they're mad at politicians, they're mad at the world.
Well, people are mad at everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So what I want to clarify is that most economists actually don't forecast. There is this perception that, we go to school and the main function of what we do when we come out is try to predict GDP, inflation, unemployment, so forth. And probably only 1 or 2% of the profession does that. The rest of the economists, the 98%, so to speak, they focus on why firms do what they do, why consumers behave the way they do, and they study what we call micro things, not the overall economy.
But people expect them to, though, Bob.
They do.
People think these are smart people. They study this stuff. We should know what the answers are.
Well, even the people that actually do the forecasting have imperfect records. There was this false certainty, certainly when I went to graduate school in the 1960s, that we could build these huge mathematical models that would predict the economy. And actually, we don't use those models anymore. I mean, the Fed has a big model, and the IMF uses one and so forth. But by and large, business doesn't use these models, and nor do most economists. They have relatively simplistic models, and they miss turning points. I mean, that's the key problem in forecasting, is that it's great to predict a trend, the one that is happening. You just predict that it's going to continue. But it's really hard to predict the turning point.
But the housing sector, there have been lots of stories in the run-up to the Great Recession that the housing sector was in woeful shape. It was ready to implode and explode and everything else. Why wasn't somebody out? And there were a couple people.
There were a few.
But why weren't more people saying, hey, wait a minute, we're going to have a major problem here?
I really can't tell you. I think a lot of them were lulled to sleep, so to speak, by the continuing expansion. And by the way, that included Alan Greenspan, who was then Federal Reserve Chairman.
Right.
I mean, he
right.
kept assuring Congress and everyone And also later, Ben Bernanke, they were assuring people that if housing prices actually did start to fall, first they wouldn't go down nationwide because that had like never happened, so they claimed. And then second, even if it happened, it would have a relatively small effect on financial markets. And of course, we know both of those things turned out not to be true.
Right, right. Well, let's turn to the flip side. The title of your book, Trillion Dollar Economists, comes from your belief that collectively the notions discussed in this book have created trillions of dollars of income and wealth for the U.S. and the rest of the world. And you back this up by telling the stories of those who developed groundbreaking theories that led to these, you know, these great advances in how things are produced and priced and consumed. Why don't these people and their ideas have, you know, they get better recognition outside the world of economics?
Economics.
I'm getting economists and economics mixed up in my head here, so bail me out. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if they read my book, they'll find out that they get the recognition they deserve.
You're doing it. Right.
Yeah. And I really wanted to acquaint readers with these people because they may read the op-ed columnists, the people that show up in the New York Times like Paul Krugman or Marty Feldstein, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, or Alan Blinder. These are household names, but they don't know a lot of the names in the book. And they don't know, for example, Julian Simon, who applied auction theory to selling off spaces on airplanes, which, by the way, was not allowed until airline fares were deregulated. Mm-hmm. But in the old days, when planes were crowded, airlines just threw people off the plane. And today, any economist would tell you they should just effectively auction off the seats, which is what they do. You know, they say, you know, who wants a voucher for 100, 200, 300? And finally, the price gets high enough and they get enough takers and people who have reservations leave. Well, economists have estimated that that one simple idea of applying auctions to full airplanes have saved consumers over $100 billion a year, over $100 billion cumulatively over several decades. That's just one story.
And so what's involved with our reticence to give these people more credit? Why are they so little known to the general public at large?
Well, I think in part because the advice they give gets incorporated in businesses, and it's the CEOs and the businesses that get credit. I'll give you a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Let's take Google. All right? Google is a company that's worth, you know, round numbers, $500 billion. Mm-hmm. They earn in ads about $60 billion a year. Those things on the right-hand side of
yes.
the page. Okay? Now, when Google started, they did not auction off those ads. By the way, today those ads are auctioned off. And the idea of an auction actually was not suggested by an economist, but it was validated when Eric Schmidt, then the CEO of Google, asked an economist named Hal Varian, who was then a professor at Berkeley, is this a good idea to auction them off? And Hal said, of course it is. And they adopted the idea, and the rest is history. I mean, now Google has real-time auctions, and they raise, as I said, something like $50, $60 billion a year off these auctions. And by the way, Hal Varian left Berkeley and went to work for Google.
Yeah.
And has since has invented a bunch of other ideas that Google has actually carried out. So who gets the credit for that? Well, among economists, they know who Hal Varian is. But, you know, the people that think of Google don't automatically think of Hal Varian. They think of Larry Page and Sergey Brin, maybe Eric Schmidt, but they think of the founders and the CEO. So that's typically what happens.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to KCUR's Up to Date, and I'm Steve Kraske. We're talking with author Robert Lighton about his new book, Trillion Dollar Economists, How Economists and Their Ideas Have Transformed Business. And this has to do with the good things, the benefits that economists have brought to us. You know, one point you make, Bob, is that until very recently, one thing economists couldn't do is the type of experimentation that those in the hard sciences live and die by. Explain why it's been so difficult to do that.
Well, you can't toy with the real economy. And that's one of the reasons why, for example, macro forecasters have a hard time testing their theories. They have to look at data within what's happened and then infer what could happen in the future. And of course, that's why they get things wrong a lot of times. But we can't run experiments like scientists can and say, what we're going to do is We're going to do a randomized experiment with 10 economies, and we're going to give one or two economies the treatment drug, namely, let's say, more spending or more monetary stimulus, and then presto, let's see what happens.
Yes.
Because no one would put up with that.
Which makes your science, your field, so much more difficult to navigate, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly. But when you go to the world of micro, at the individual level, individual firms, you can run experiments. And so, for example, there's something called A-B testing, which a lot of the techies have heard about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the idea that on a website, they can change the way they present the information in an A version or a B version and see if consumers respond differently. And they can run these experiments all the time. In fact, there's one company called Capital One, which many of our listeners know about.
Sure.
They've probably gotten a credit card solicitation. Well, they run over 60,000 experiments a year with both their employees and their customers. And they'll send out different kinds of solicitations in different colors with different words. And they've got data trackers to try to figure out which thing actually works.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can run experiments at the micro level where people actually don't even know they're being experimented on. By the way, when you go to Google, you don't see the same thing every time Google pops up.
Yeah.
You see a different font. And that the people at Google are constantly doing A-B testing with you, and you may not even be aware of it.
That's interesting. And so the tradition among economists has been to rely on data to reveal, you know, how an economy is running, Bob. I bet in the early days of economics, collecting data had to be pretty difficult. I mean, data is the lifeblood for those in your field, right? And
right.
How much did the advent of the computer then change the game for y'all?
Oh, it changed it hugely. And in fact, so-called Moore's Law, which says that computing power doubles every 18 months or 2 years, has vastly increased computing power. And I'm sure you've heard the analogy that you've got more computing power in your smartphone than they had in the computer that
right.
sent the man to the moon,
sure.
which is true. So what that means is that economists now can process huge amounts of data. So one of the leading economists right now, who is in his 30s at Harvard, he's not mentioned in the book, by the way, because a lot of things have happened since I wrote the book. There's an economist named Raj Chetty, all right? He's a brilliant guy. He's analyzed all kinds of data sets to figure out how mobile people are in terms of their income over time.
Mm-hmm.
And he's looked at different socioeconomic groups. He's asked the question, are different cities, for example, do they display different patterns of mobility?
Mm.
And he's found that some cities, especially those in the South, for example, it's very hard for those at the bottom to move up. Whereas in other cities, you know, let's say in California, it's much more fluid and people do rise to the top more rapidly. That's just one example, but that result comes about through crunching lots and lots of data.
Well, you say the words, you know, data mining these days, and you're likely to get a dirty look. Just how big a role does that play in economics, and does that wind up getting a bad rap?
Well, data mining in the sense that I'm just going to throw a bunch of data on the computer and see if I can detect patterns, that is a bad rap. At least it gets a bad rap among economists because there's no theory of how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And when companies like Google data mine, they tend to have a theory. They tend to have a hypothesis like scientists, and they want to test something. And then they use all the data, which is all the click-through data that they've got on their searches,
mm-hmm.
to see whether or not something actually conforms to their theory. Now, I'll give you a perfect example of the usefulness of data mining, and it happens to do with sports. We mentioned this at the outset. So there's a man who grew up not very far from where we're talking, named Bill James, who basically pioneered the whole idea.
He's from Lawrence, Kansas.
He's from Lawrence, Kansas, mm-hmm. worked out of his basically a sort of a garage-like separate
amazing
part of his house, wasn't part of his house. And he crunched numbers and tried to predict the performance of players using very rudimentary statistical techniques. Well, now the so-called science of sabermetrics, it's now called, which is basically using sports data, performance data, to predict future performance of individuals and teams, is used now by virtually every baseball team.
Yes.
And it's used by football teams and basketball
yes.
teams and hockey teams and
soccer teams.
To
more and more, to a greater extent
yes.
every year. Yeah.
And so the old line scout, who was, you know, the tobacco-chewing scout who was sort of bumming around the country, they've been largely displaced by these kids crunching numbers
yes.
who may have never played a sport in their lives.
Yeah. Robert Lighton's my guest. We're talking about economists and the benefits they bring to all of us, whether you believe it or not. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR up to date. You know, when it comes to those involved in big data, you point out that universities are just beginning to catch up to industry's need for a whole new generation of data scientists. I mean, individuals who have training in multiple fields, primarily statistics and computer science, but also economics and perhaps one or more of the physical or biological sciences. How do you create a college major for something that's spread across so many disciplines like that, Bob?
Well, the field of statistics generally is where you start. And in fact, you know, I've had a lot of research assistants work for me during the course of my career, and they've had different backgrounds. But when kids come to me today and ask, you know, what should I do? I tell them that they have any mathematical ability at all. What you should do is major in statistics, but take a lot of computer courses, because you'll have the ability to crunch numbers, and that can be used not only in the tech industry. It can be used in pharmaceuticals. It can be used by mainline manufacturing. It can be used almost throughout the economy. Mm-hmm. Retailers, for example, everybody's analyzing data, and if you're a data analyst, the world is open to you. The startup world, the established world, you'll be able to have a career the likes of which, you know, maybe previous generations, let's say, of doctors would have had.
But you're suggesting that universities need to catch up a little bit here and get with it.
Way. I mean, private industry is way ahead of universities.
It should be just the opposite.
Well,
I mean, theory.
In theory, but, you know, this is an example where essentially the quote-unquote science got way ahead of the teaching. And so companies like Google and Amazon, Yahoo, and others have employed statisticians well in advance of what the universities were teaching. And only now, for example, do we see schools trying to catch up. And eventually they'll turn out the kids who are trained in this stuff. And as I said, if you know computers and you know statistics, the world's your oyster.
You know, one thing that struck me about the individuals you write about in the book, it was surprising to me how many weren't formally trained in the field. I mean, some studied related fields like math or finance. Some didn't finish college before heading out into the real world to test their ideas. What commonalities did you sort of come up with as you worked on this, Bob?
Well, I sort of had a slanted view. Of course, I was looking for people who had economic training.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And so I focus on a number of companies, for example, where the founder actually studied economics. They may not have gotten a PhD, but they knew enough. And so I'll give you a perfect example. Priceline was founded by Jay Walker, who I've since come to know rather well. Jay studied economics as an undergraduate at Cornell. And he obviously paid a lot of attention to his lectures because then when he grew up later on in life, he realized that there was a huge problem when the internet started, and that was empty hotel beds and empty seats on airplanes.
Yeah, so interesting.
All right? And so what he developed was a way for people to bid for these empty slots. But, and here is his crucial insight, you have to bid in a way so that the people who are already paying full freight won't just drop their reservations and then start bidding for the empty seats. In other words, you want to introduce price discrimination so that people who have the seats stay and they pay for them full price. But the ones that are left over at the last minute basically go to people who have much more flexibility in their travel time, kids on vacation or older people who really don't care about when they fly. And they really almost don't care, you know, on a particular hotel as long as they get one particular hotel. And so he introduced the idea of name your own price pricing, and Priceline's taken off. Priceline, by the way, has a market value today of $60 billion plus.
Give or take a few. Yeah. It's a billion here and a billion there, and pretty soon you're talking about real money. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888 for Bob Lighton. Claudia from Kansas City, Missouri. Claudia, you're on Up to Date. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Bob, how do economists account for population density in determining quality of life when measuring the economy?
Interesting. Population density, Bob.
So that's a very good question.
Yes.
You know, there are a lot of measures of quality of life, and I don't want to bore listeners with, you know, you could measure it by income, longevity, how long you live, and so forth. But one of the things that economist study that's very related to density is something we call productivity, which is how much value do you add relative to the amount of labor that you put in. So what are the most highly productive places? Well, they turn out to be really dense places, cities. It turns out that despite the so-called death of distance that everybody forecast about the internet, what's happened instead is that places like New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and here in Kansas City, places that have what are called high agglomerations of people, especially people who have college degrees and are well-educated, they tend to feed off each other, mm-hmm. and they become more productive. And so actually, dense places tend to be more productive than places that are spread out.
Does that help, Claudia?
No. It's somewhat helpful, but I think doesn't really get to a lot of what I was asking.
Well, I think what you were asking also is other qualities of life, like traffic and congestion and things like that, pollution and things like that. And almost by definition, smaller places are less dense. I live in one, by the way. I now live in Wichita, Kansas, which is less dense than Kansas City. And one reason I live there is because I don't have to be in so much traffic. And so that's one negative of mm-hmm. living in a highly congested place. On the other hand, the income per capita in Kansas City is greater in Kansas City, actually, than it is in Wichita.
Yeah.
And one reason is there's greater density and higher population.
You know, another trend that you point out is that companies these days are hiring their own in-house economists. I mean, name some companies that have done that and why. And isn't that why you'd have a chief financial officer to begin with?
Well, chief financial officers track the books. They don't actually implement economic theories. And by the way, in the old days, a lot of economists had chief economists, but they were employed as forecasters.
Yeah.
And then CEOs realized, well, they're not of any use. And Warren Buffett has a great quote, by the way, about how useless economic forecasters are. You can Google it and find it.
That sounds like Warren Buffett, by the way.
But the new kind of economist that companies are hiring, like Hal Varian at Google, there's a chief economist at Amazon and at other tech companies. They're people that are hired to try to implement some avant-garde economic ideas, like, for example, auction theory. Mm-hmm. Ways of pricing, ways of analyzing customer data that the old line economists never knew how to do. So mm-hmm. we have a new generation of data analysts and theorists who are working for a lot of new age companies.
Let me go to Don from Kansas City, Missouri. Don, you're on UpToDate. Nice to have you.
Okay, thank you. You were saying that it's very difficult for macroeconomists mm-hmm. to conduct experiments in the real economy. I'm just wondering if economists are now looking at the state of Kansas, where the governor has himself said that what he's doing is an experiment in slashing corporate business taxes in order to grow the economy. I'm just asking, are real economists looking at this as a valid experiment in macroeconomics?
That's a really good question.
That is too, yes.
Yeah, so when I was referring to the macroeconomy, I was referring to the country as a whole. But you're absolutely right that different states pursuing different strategies are experimenting in the way that, for example, individual firms would be. And so I can guarantee you there will be PhD theses written about the Brownback experiment. Of course, we're in the middle of it right now, and it's hard to separate out, for example, the tax cut that you refer to from all the other factors. So you have to control for all these other factors. And it takes a number of years to do that, but I can guarantee you that within the next 5 or 10 years, we'll have a much better fix on whether the so-called Brownback experiment worked.
Well, thank you.
Don, thank you. I should point out that Bob Lighten will be discussing trillion-dollar economists on Tuesday at the Central Kansas City Public Library branch downtown. To reserve a seat, go to kclibrary.org. Again, that's at 6 o'clock this coming Tuesday at the Central Branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library downtown. Bob Lighten's new book, Trillion-Dollar Economists, How Economists and Their Ideas Have Transformed Business. And thanks so much for your time today, Bob. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you.